This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. It is a Thursday, the 25th of May. Good news is we've got Tom Urquhart back from France, so we'll be hearing some of his stories and his economic insights throughout the podcast this morning. What else have we got for you? Well, we're going to kick off with electric cars because the global CEO of Polestar, the Swedish electric car maker, is in the UAE. And Tom was speaking to Thomas Ingerlath, the CEO of Polestar. But we got so many messages about electric vehicles. A lot of people questioning just how green are they? What does it take to make the batteries? Where does the electricity come from to power these things? So we're going to be looking at some of your messages on that. What else have we got for you? Real estate this morning with a great guy, the Saudi property tycoon Abdullah Al-Ajaji. He's the founder of Driven Properties. He's based here in the UAE, but he's a Saudi guy. Really good guy. I'm going to get his thoughts on that. And finally, looking at the debt ceiling crisis in the United States, we've been speaking to our correspondent in Minnesota, Tony B. Graham. All of that to come.
Let's talk all things electric vehicles, if we can. Listeners to the Business Breakfast will have heard a little earlier on this week the comments of Craig Stevens. He's the CEO of DubiCars.com, based right here in Dubai. Craig joined us to give us his thoughts about the potential for electric vehicles here. He said, yeah, we all know about the potential, but he was a little bit concerned and has a few examples and answers as to why more people haven't made the move yet to EVs.
Well, firstly, let me say, I think this market is different, right? We've got a love affair with big engines, right, to start off with. Secondly, we don't do many miles in our cars. I mean, we're very low mileage in this country compared to anywhere else, because it's a fairly small country. Thirdly, we have the fuel ferry comes at night and fills up your cars. You don't have the pain of going to the petrol station and filling up your car. And fuel is fairly cheap. So all those things together mean I haven't got the motivation to change to an EV. I don't think the UAE is ready for it. So I think there's something like a 180, 200 charging stations in Dubai, but there's only 29 in Abu Dhabi. There's 11 in Sharjah. So, you know, if you're driving outside of Dubai, you're going to struggle even more.
So Craig thinks that we're not ready for it at the moment in so many words. Well, what about those that are invested heavily into the electric vehicle market? Polestar is a Swedish automotive electric performance car brand determined to improve the society that we live in. Their CEO is, of course, Thomas Ingerlath, who joined in 2017 from Volvo Cars, where he was the SVP of design. Prior to that, he held various design management roles at Škoda Auto and Volkswagen. Thomas has been kind enough to join us live on the line from Abu Dhabi this morning. Thomas, thanks for your time.
Yeah, good morning, Tom. Hi.
Let's get your reaction first and foremost to what Craig said to us a little earlier on this week. The UAE isn't ready for electric vehicles.
You're right. I listened to what he has to say, and I would reply the convenience of having a fully charged car in the morning, of course. That is foremost the starting point for everybody. You don't have to charge during a day, mostly going from Abu Dhabi to Dubai and back, you can do it with one charge. So even in today's situation with charging stations, you have a very comfortable life with an EV as well. Now, our company is promoting electric cars because, yes, we want to help reducing the CO2 footprint of the world mobility, but it's as well about the fun of driving electric car. So even if you're very much into driving great cars with great engines, it's even greater cars with electric engines. The acceleration, the way electric cars drives, is just the more enjoyable and modern way. So for all the car nuts and big engine lovers, I would really recommend trying one of our EVs and enjoying how enjoyable and great it is to drive these cars.
It's an important point to make as well, I think, Thomas, when you talk about the potentials in the market. A lot of people will just think of the EVs coming in one shape, one size, one fits all, etc. As you say, though, there's so much potential in the different options within the EV market.
Now, approaching it from the angle of design, the abilities of really shaping great new cars, very different cars. We have a range here of a modern aerodynamic SUV. We have a great roadster on the other end of our palette. I think the opportunities and really creativity that it opens up is it's a new age. We all saw how car design and cars became actually, you know, quite similar looking. You would have said 10 years ago, oh, car design business is all getting going a bit stale. Now with electrification, there's a new energy and a new wave. And I mean, even the big OEMs are having a great new era ahead of them.
We are living in the year of sustainability, Thomas, and obviously part and parcel of that is the adoption of electric vehicles, with COP28 just on the horizon as well. What does the automotive industry need to do as a whole to become more sustainable?
To look beyond electrification, the big issue for not only the car industry, the whole industry, is to become a CO2-free industry. That's an amazing journey still ahead of us. And whoever thought that the step to electrification is a big revolution, really taking now the CO2 footprint out of the goods that we produce, that's a big major task for the whole society and the industry. That will be incredible revolution.
Obviously, we're seeing the potential here with the UA sustainability agenda being well documented as well. Just back to our original point, though, Thomas, that we made about the infrastructure being put in place here to accommodate the move to electric vehicles. Could more be done? Could it be done quicker?
I think that's that being impatient and asking for it to be quicker. Yeah, that's a temptation. Having said that, to respect how much effort is being put into doing the infrastructure, the ambition to become 2050 climate neutral, all of that, I think, deserves high respect. And I think the agenda that the UAE government has decided on, it's very remarkable.
And just finally, obviously, down in Abu Dhabi for a major event, you and the Polestar team, are you ambitious as to the potential, or not just the UAE, but the GCC for Polestar?
This region is a very, very good market for us, since it combines the two things. The ambition about advancing in CO2-free mobility on one hand, and on the other hand, the premium luxury market that we find here. It's exactly the combination of where the brand Polestar operates, where we have our great premium products, and where, yeah, again, back to where we started, it's not only about driving an electric car, it's about driving an amazing, beautiful, and premium new piece of technology. And I think that is something that the customers here will appreciate.
Well, you've got a number of very, very keen listeners out there at the moment, Thomas. Abdul Salam being one of those, saying he's waiting for his Polestar 3. He's on the reservation list at the moment, so looking forward to that one. Thomas, thanks very much indeed. All the best with your event down in Abu Dhabi today. That was Thomas Ingenlath, the CEO of Polestar, joining us live from Abu Dhabi.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on Dubai1038.com.
Tom, lots of reaction to your interview about electronic vehicles with the CEO of Polestar, the Swedish electric vehicle company.
Everyone has an opinion on all things EV. And I think it goes back to a comment that you made in the first hour of the show this morning about, yeah, we often talk about what's your buy-in level when it comes to cars and what is the sort of average spend on cars? Yeah, we know you got supercars out there, et cetera, top of the market. And there's not that many old bangers on the road here, are there? But there is a few. But what is the mid? It changes, doesn't it, when we talk EV, because it is a higher buy-in. Regardless of what model you buy and what brand you are buying, you are going to have to fork out more to be an early adopter. A lot of people are getting involved in the conversation today. Abdul Salam, who's on the wait list for a Polestar 3 at the moment, asking Thomas to hurry that one along. We'll do all the best we can. Saying that he's waiting for his. Bob said, look, existing apartments do not have sufficient electrical infrastructure to allow charging points to each parking space. They're only limited to villas. Good point, well made, Bob. Thank you very much indeed. Somebody no name with this one saying, sadly, most of us can't afford an EV, so we're being priced out of the market. This one from Tawab Kazemi getting in touch, saying, I think EV is a fad and the future is, in fact, hydrogen cars. No range issues there. Mariam got in touch saying, I'm shopping for a new EV at the moment. Tesla is expensive. I was hoping that Polestar would offer something cheaper, but their website shows only the SUV and smaller ones haven't come to the UAE as yet. And also following up with another point, saying also, other than the Tesla, I see very little support for the EV market here. VW, Kia have some amazing and cheaper EVs, but no agency has the license for them yet, and so we have to import as well. There's still a few hurdles.
There are hurdles, no question at all, but some of them are cheap. And now, when you were away, we had, and we heard from him earlier, Craig from Doobie Cars.
Doobie or Dubby?
Oh, potato, potato.
It's exactly that. And I always feel too embarrassed to ask Craig when he's in.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. He's a big guy as well, so you don't want to upset him. But he said you can buy an electric vehicle here for 35,000, 40,000 dirhams, which, to the point of the message that says, sadly, most of us can't afford one. And I get it. You've got the Polestar, I think, I looked earlier, it's about 160-ish thousand dirhams is the starting price. I checked it earlier. That's about right. And we checked yesterday, or the day before, the cheapest Tesla is about the same, 160,000. So it's not a cheap car. But you can buy a Chang'an Benben E-Star in Dubai today, Thomas.
Chitty bang bang.
It's yours for 40,000 dirhams. It's a 2000, and I'm not endorsing it at all. I've never heard of it. But on Doobie Cars, and I'm sure it's the same on other platforms, there's lots of Chang'an Benben E-Stars, electric cars,
bang,
for
bang.
About 45,000 dirhams. The cheapest one, I'm looking at the Doobie Cars website. Cheapest one's probably not appropriate. 25,000 dirhams, you can get a Wuling golf buggy.
Oh, wow.
But you wouldn't want to be taking that down Shakeside
Road. Is that roadworthy?
I don't think it is.
Don't know. It is an investment at the moment. Amit got in touch with us saying, hey, all, I'd like to share another view why the UAE needs further to widen the option for its is for residential apartments parking spaces to be EV friendly because the time it takes for a full charge. I was looking for an EV some time back, but was advised against it because of where I live. No charging points in my building.
And that is a massive issue, isn't it? Because most people live in apartments.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're living in a 1980s building in Karama, it does not have an EV charging point in the basement. Okay, maybe if you're living in one of the very new buildings, they will have an EV charging point. Or if you're lucky enough to work in an office in a swanky building where they've got EV charging points. But that's not the reality for most people.
I notice it every time I go to Mall of the Emirates. I'm one of those weirdos that like to park where, you know, no other cars are, basically. I'm not that person that wants to park opposite the entrance. So I usually go up to the sort of top area where they have the big Tesla charging area.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what time of day you go, it is always rammed in there.
Yeah.
And that invariably that's a lot of the Tesla taxis, isn't it, that are using those banks down there at the moment. As you say, the infrastructure and the problem they're in. And you just got to look at it, haven't you? I mean, there is a very significant footfall when it comes to apartment living here. If everyone in your apartment block has transitioned over to EV, there ain't going to be enough charging spaces. And if everyone's charging at the same time, what does that mean?
Yeah, it's...
It's going to put a surge on the grid, isn't it, Rich?
Well, it is. And someone wrote in yesterday or the day before saying, it's all well and good people with electric vehicles saying, oh, I've got a lean green car. How is the electricity for your car generated? Was one question. Now, here we've got, is it 20-odd% of our electricity is generated by solar? So that is green. The rest is natural gas, which is cleaner than diesel, we know, and significantly so. Someone's written in, how many points do you have in the ARN car park? I wouldn't know. Because I haven't got a parking spot.
Ooh.
Unlike Serena Kelly, who's with us in the studio.
Now, morning, now. I haven't actually seen any, but I do know a few of members of staff do have EV electric vehicles. But I think a couple of weeks ago, we were reporting that the Ministry of Energy and Infrastructure planned to increase the number of EV outlets to 800 in the next year. So, I mean, because obviously they're hearing what everyone's saying and they're trying to move forward to make sure that these charging points are going to be readily available. Because let's face it, I mean, how else are we going to reach net zero by 2050?
That's a fair point.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's talk properties, if we can, here in the UAE. Let's look at the wider GCC markets in general. Who better to talk to than the team at Driven Properties, established back in 2012. They've grown into a leading property brokerage, investment and consultancy company under the leadership of their founder, Abdullah Alajaji, who's been kind enough to join us live in studio. Abdullah, good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back here in the studio as well. Okay, let's talk. I never really know how to start the conversation about the market in general, because the market is so diverse, especially here in Dubai, where we are conducting this interview at the moment. Yeah, we read the headlines about Jumeirah Bay and the extraordinary prices that properties are going for there. True to say that that is the go-to location, the outperformer in the market at the moment?
Oh, definitely the outlier in terms of outperformance. It's outperformed every category as an area, as a location. The ultra-high end of the market, which, you know, all of the properties in that island sit, have outperformed every other category in the market, be it the medium to high end, the high end, the luxury market, or obviously the affordable market. So absolutely, yeah.
Is it, and again, I hope this comes across in the right way, is it a victim of its own success to a certain degree? I mean, by its very nature, it is an island, and therefore there is limited real estate on that particular island. At which point does it get to a point where the prices just can't go any further?
That's the thing. That's what happens with scarcity. You have very limited supply. It is a very small island. There is a point where you know, new supply comes to market, new luxury supply comes to market. There is a new island just right next to Jumeirah Bay. That's, you know, that where they're planning launches either late this year or early next year, which is the peninsula with beautiful you know, destinations in that island that could provide some competition, thereby you know, reducing the rate of these incredible hikes in prices. So yeah, but then because of scarcity and tremendous demand, especially from the ultra high net worth individuals, the wealthy that have been moving to Dubai, permanent movers to Dubai, that created that demand with very, very limited supply. I mean, you only have places like the Palm Jumeirah, and only, you know, certain fronts or certain categories of that market that competes with Jumeirah Bay. Then you have the inland living like Emirates Hills and Dubai Hills. But most of these affluent individuals and families, they like waterfront living. They like the convenience of being next to the Four Seasons, the Bulgari Hotel, the Mandarin Oriental, the IFC downtown, and so on.
That supply and demand mechanic and dynamic that we're seeing at the moment. I mean, yeah, we know it's happening down at Jumeirah Bay Island and a couple of the other seafronting properties that you mentioned there. Is that sort of indicative of the market as a whole, though?
No. Well, the interesting thing that we're seeing here in this bull market cycle, let's call it that, we've had several cycles. You know, you've seen in Dubai the 2000 to 2007, 2008 kind of cycle. That was the longest bull market cycle. And then we had the period of kind of, you know, 2012 to 2014-ish. And then this cycle, right? And the difference between this cycle and these other cycles is that you see, in this cycle, you see real demand supply fundamentals at work, whereby you see some areas that barely had any moves or maybe single digit moves in some affordable areas, because the market knows that there could be future supply. There's abundance of land that could be developed that could create more competition to the existing inventory. Whereas, you know, there are areas where there is very, very limited supply and no future supply in sight or very limited future supply in sight, where these you know properties moved 2x and sometimes 3x. Like you had 200% moves in some cases. In Jumeirah Bay Island specifically, there's been areas that went or certain projects that went 3x over the prices of 4 or 5 years ago. Where you go to International City or Dubai Land, you barely see any moves, both on the rental and the sales side. So if you look at previous cycles, you've seen index moves. So you see, you know, Al Furjan moves in the same way downtown moves. You both move in the 20-25% ranges over a year's time. So it was more speculative activity at the time because there was still abundance of future supply coming. There was so many projects that are still coming online. But in this cycle, we're seeing a lot a very mature market.
But the index is still moving at the moment.
Absolutely. I mean, the overall index has moved up. But again, you know, as I said, you have areas that went up just a tiny bit, single digits, and you have areas that went up 2x. Overall, we've seen a year-on-year increases in 2021 and 2022 and Q1 2023 so far as well.
I don't think there's any denying that the sort of high net worth individual play that we're seeing at the moment and those triple digit increases that we're seeing in certain areas is having a knock-on effect, a trickle-down effect into the market as a whole. But is it also... I mean, again, are the taps still on at present? The headlines that are being written about certain amounts being paid for certain properties, is that attracting more high net worth individuals into the city, into the market?
That's, I mean, two things are happening here. One is what's happening on that side. It's pricing out some of the, you know, the buyers that used to afford that kind of luxury. I mean, there were people that bought a land in Jumeirah Bay Island just over 2 years ago for $37 million. And now they're selling that for the tune of 125. So they're saying, you know what, you know, I just made three times my capital or four times my capital, and I'm better off selling it. And then there is that person that still believes there is value at that level because there is nothing else, and that's where he wants to be, and there's no supply. But in terms of trickling down, we've also seen people moving to the mid and the mid market moving upwards, the mid to high end market moving upwards because of these guys being priced out of the ultra luxury market.
Mm. How does it compare with other markets? I mean, so we're coming into the summer months at the moment. Yeah. Variably, that's when people travel, etc. They might go to their summer houses or other properties around the world. Is the UAE, is the GCC unique at the moment compared to other real estate markets?
Absolutely. I mean, you look at Sweden, for example. We've seen headlines yesterday that their market has come down to the tune of 15% since the beginning of the year, and that's at that scale, it's massive. You see the U.S. market struggling because of interest rate hikes. You see Europe, especially at the high end of the market, London, the south of France, south of Spain. You see struggles in these markets at this time, predominantly because of the interest rate hikes and the you know the debt ceiling talks and so on. What the markets, how the equity markets are behaving, that's all trickling down to the sentiment in real estate market. Dubai, it's singing its own song, and the UAE in general, we're seeing activity in Abu Dhabi. Iraq is launching new projects, so it's fundamentally that demand is sticky because we are seeing the world moving to Dubai. You're seeing people moving from Europe permanently with their families, relocating, people moving in from Russia, and more recently from Asia. You see families relocate from Hong Kong, from Singapore. So Dubai has taken market share from all of these markets that have been, traditionally active markets and very buoyant markets. And Dubai has taken the show.
Long may that continue. Abdullah, of course, thanks so much indeed to you and your team for joining us. Abdullah Al-Ajaji is the founder of Driven Properties. Join us live here in studio.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Big focus on economic stories this morning, including the US debt ceiling. dancing on the ceiling with the US debt ceiling crisis continuing. Going to get the thoughts of our correspondent in the United States, Tony B. Graham, shortly. First of all, let's just remind us what the two sides have been saying. First of all, Joe Biden, President of the United States, he wants to raise the debt ceiling by the 1st of June to make sure America keeps paying its bills. And he has been talking to the Republicans.
We had a productive meeting yesterday and with all four leaders in the Congress. It was civil and respectful. And everyone came to the meeting, I think, in good faith. I'm confident that we'll get the agreement on the budget, that America will not default. And every leader in the room understands the consequences if we fail to pay our bills. And it would be catastrophic for the American economy and the American people if we didn't pay our bills.
Okay, so that's the Democratic point of view. The Republicans, though, are playing hardball. They think that the United States is spending too much money, that the Democrats are too profligate, and they want to rein in spending. So, yes, they're talking, but this is Kevin McCarthy, who's leading the negotiations for the Republicans.
How much is too much? You're sitting almost at a $32 trillion debt. Your debt is now larger than your economy. You're going to pay more in interest in the next 10 years than you paid in the last 80 years. We can no longer ignore this problem.
Fitch Ratings Agency has put the United States AAA rating on negative watch over the past 24 hours, citing brinkmanship over the debt ceiling. This is what Fitch has to say. The US, of course, has a AAA rating, one of the very few countries in the world that has that. The rating watch negative reflects increased political partisanship that is hindering reaching a solution to raise or suspend the debt limit, despite the fast approaching X date, which they call it. The so-called X date, which is when the US could default on its debt, could arrive as early as June the 1st, according to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. Right, let's get some perspective now. Tony B. Graham is one of our correspondents in the United States. He's based in Wisconsin, in the northern part of the United States, in the Great Lakes area, former Dubai resident and a friend of the Business Breakfast. We asked him to characterize the U.S. debt ceiling story for us.
The debt ceiling story is about brinkmanship, pure and simple, and it's driven by two things. The first is that Speaker Kevin McCarthy has a really tenuous hold over his party, and therefore a tenuous hold on his speakership. He's got just a razor-thin majority in the House of Representatives. So whereas his members in competitive districts are under huge pressure to pass a clean debt ceiling increase in order to avoid economic calamity, the problem is the far-right members of his party don't appear to be worried about that at all. They seem to be willing to destroy the global economy to make a political point. The second factor driving this is really a continuation of Republican Party obstructionism. So when the GOP controlled Congress during the Trump administration, they passed a debt ceiling increase in 2017, in 2018, and in 2019 without any preconditions, and even did so whilst lowering tax revenues by way of tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans. So when a Republican president is in office, there's no objection. But when a Democrat's in the White House, then the debt ceiling becomes effectively a tool for high-stakes political blackmail. I think it's worth noting here that Congress has increased the debt ceiling 78 times since 1960s, because they have to, because what's at stake here isn't just the full faith and credit of the United States, but also, by default, a great deal of global economic stability. This didn't used to be a partisan issue. What's interesting is that amongst ordinary Americans, there doesn't seem to be much concern yet. This has happened so many times that few people actually believe the government will default. What's concerning, however, is that few people here understand the gravity of what is actually at stake.
Full disclosure, Tony B. Graham was the head of Democrats Abroad here in the UAE when he lived here. So, of course, he does have partisanship, as most people in the United States do. We bring you a range of different views, but full disclosure on that one. Thomas.
Is it a concern? I mean, as you mentioned there, and the word you're hearing quite a lot with this one is brinksmanship out there. A lot of people on Capitol Hill are thinking that things will get sorted out. But time is running out. I mean, it's this time next week, June the 1st, which is D-Day or X-Day, whatever they're calling it at the moment. And take into account there's also a holiday weekend in the United States this coming weekend as well. So that's going to extend things. So you can sort of understand the nerves of many. The three big stock indexes all slipping yesterday. So that's extending falls from the previous day as well. So wait and see. June the 1st, this time next week.
Maybe we'll be at work. Maybe we won't.
So, I mean, okay, let's play doom and gloom. What happens if they do?
Nothing. I don't think people are off work for 3 days because they can't get paid the salaries, and then they figure it out. Yeah, as Tony said, they've done it 70 times over the past few decades. It's not quite an annual affair, but almost. There's a message come in saying, let it default, the sooner the better. I didn't see the name on that message. I don't need to. I know who's written it. It's Arno, isn't it?
Is it the Arno?
It's our Bitcoin bull who thinks we need to completely reconstruct. Let me check. It is Arno, yes. Arno's a big fan of Bitcoin. He thinks the whole fiat money system is flawed. But Arno, as ever, we appreciate your strident views.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.